My name is Syed Mohsin Abbas. I'm a journalist. I'm a presenter. I worked within various socio-political projects around Britain. And I tend to generally work as a commentator on channels like Press TV, occasionally RT. That's my bag.
What about your background, though? What, you know, where do you study, in the UK or elsewhere? How did you get into journalism?
I trained in Westminster Uni, and then went on to the BBC. Worked a short while on World Service as a freelancer, and I worked as a reporter on Henry Grafton. That was the National Radio Service at that time, mainly on ethnic minority Asian type shows. And then I moved on to Channel 4, making documentaries with largely the multicultural department again at that time, making documentaries of all kinds, really, political. We did things that were political, cultural, social back then. And then I've continued in journalism since, really, continued working for all sorts of channels. I listed TV, Press TV, and other channels as well.
Okay, so what about this meeting in Geneva this week between Biden and Putin? I wonder, what do you think? How do you think relations are between the US and Russia? Because we've had the disappearance, if you can call it that, of the ambassadors for the first time in hundreds of years, actually, that there's been no US ambassador in Moscow and no Russian or Soviet ambassador in Washington.
Well, they can only be described, the relations, as being rock bottom, quite frankly. Not since the Soviet era have things been quite as bad as this. And of course, the discussions that were meant to take place in Switzerland were going to cover any number of the areas of, if you like, quite major difference. That's the most most conservative way I can describe it, including arms control, you know, US allegations of Russian cyber attacks. And you know, there was nothing really major that was expected as a breakthrough. But the meeting, I think, was just really setting out the stage for the engagement during Biden's period in office.
Do you think it's really going to make much difference between the Trump era, Biden now being in power? Because I look at him and I think, well, this guy doesn't really run the show. His advisors, the Pentagon, the deep state, are probably much more wearing the boots and, you know, with the trousers or whatever. You know, Biden seems to be the sort of guy that delivers the message, but he doesn't really seem to be the man in charge.
I think he looks most overtly like that of all recent presidents. I think Obama came across as though he was a president who was engaged and had some sort of policy direction. Trump certainly did. You know, he was cast as a man of his own, if you like, inclinations. But ultimately, those who know understand that the US infrastructure, the political infrastructure, and even the economic infrastructure ultimately limits the United States to doing what's in its political economic interests. And I think it's the interests which always dictate how things run. And in this case, US interests do collide with the Russians, and they've been colliding for a very long time. They collided, of course, most visibly in the Ukraine. But prior to that, Russia's moves in Georgia were really directed at NATO and the West's increasing desire to, if you like, coerce the former Soviet satellite states into their own, if you like, pacts with NATO, with the European Union, etc. And Russia, quite frankly, under Putin, wasn't going to have that. And I think this is one of the major clashes, is really Russian security and the need for states that border Russia to be, if you like, neutral. And the Russians would say neutral. The Americans would say servile satellite states. But either way, they're on the borders of Russia, and Russia doesn't simply want American bases, soldiers, NATO bases arms, etc., bristling across its border directly. And that's what the main play is in that region. Of course, there are economic reasons as well, but I think it's primarily it's geopolitical military concerns. They've clashed, of course, further afield. The clashes in Syria and the Middle East are the other most significant and obvious ones in terms of military, economic and geopolitical significance. It's really quite clear that Russia's engagement and involvement in Syria was primed to prevent America essentially gazumping Syria for itself. Syria was the last major foothold that the Russians had, and was also its access in a way to the Mediterranean as well. So it was a vital link, and the Russian military and air force involvement in Syria that made a major impact, played a major role in preventing Assad from falling. The overall context was really that the Americans were looking for a domino effect using the likes of their own proxies, such as Jabhat al-Nusra, or whether it's ISIS, you want to call it, or whether you want to call them, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, any number of the mercenary Islamist groups in the Middle East. All of them, if you look at carefully, have money trails going back to America and American interests. Well, Russia stepped in there as well, and has essentially been a major partner in the spoiler for that little arrangement that Israel, America, etc., wanted in the Middle East. Economically, there are factors as well, but I'd say these are two of the major collisions and clashes that resulted in the Americans and the Russians really being upset. But of course, I mentioned cyber warfare, and that's really another major, major area which is increasingly becoming a huge factor in the way big powers play the game.
Well, there's a major problem with cyber warfare. I mean, you know, it's to a larger extent than almost any other type of warfare, whether that's psychological warfare, whether it's space warfare, or whether it's, you know, actually shooting warfare, is that it's almost impossible to tell where a cyber attack has come from.
Yes, for sure. I mean, of course, the Americans have been using this as a card to label the Russians as, a threat in the minds of their own publics. It's quite easy to play with the public's minds on this, i.e. The cyber attacks, which they're alleging the Russians have done, center very much around the politics and the elections of presidents themselves. I mean, Trump was massively put forward by campaigns within the media in America as being somebody who'd actually benefited from the interference of Putin. None of that has been proven. There's been no proof. But what we do know is that around the world, you know, one thing we know in the Israel-Iran cyber warfare, you can see that all little places like nuclear installations are going up in flames, and tit-for-tat destruction of infrastructure like that is very, very much a part of modern warfare. I don't think in the American-Russian case we've got sort of installations going up in flames and whatnot, but certainly people have access to each other's, data. And the cyber warfare is the one which at the moment often actually also preempts the whole on the ground military, which is even more dangerous. Some would argue that, you know, if you had a Russian American confrontation, essentially talking about two nations which can own 80% of the nuclear weapons in the world. And so, you know, you'd rather they were tinkering around with each other's cyberspace than launching nukes at each other. I mean, arguably, but it's still something that could escalate, because it's another factor that, I mean, one of the things about the traffic of cyberspace, it's alleged that Tel Aviv is the central nerve center, if you like, the nerve center of all traffic for intelligence and cyber information, which means ultimately that Israel can play a part. And another factor that I have to bring in, really, America, Russia, etc. I mean, they are national and state players. Undoubtedly, they have their own independent policies and directions. So the Americans, Russians have that. But you cannot discount the power and influence of the likes of the Rothschilds and other money mafia entities, which are really independent, if you like, players on an international scale themselves. These people, both in America and in Russia and arguably China, have financial investments. They benefit no matter what conflicts go on. So there's one line of arguments that says that actually stoking up a Russian American conflict or a Sino-American conflict actually will proliferate more business, more conflict, more wars, more weapons. All of this is sales, all this is money, all of this is fear, all of this is people and nations at each other's throats, while actually the money lenders and the money mafia who control whether it's Wall Street or whether it's Hong Kong or the exchanges in London, these guys are actually the winners of all such confrontations.
With cyber warfare, the biggest and the most serious attacks that I've seen so far seem to have been on Iran. I mean, who's behind those ones? Do we know?
It's been really an open secret. I mean, those who know. The reality is the Iranians know. And our sources tell us very clearly that incidents such as the automatic or cyber triggered attack on the head of their nuclear program not so long ago. Fakhrizadeh was the name of the head of the nuclear program in Iran. He was assassinated while traveling on a road, I think, from Tehran out or in, I can't remember exactly, but it was a virtual attack. I mean, there were the system that triggered it was not involving actually individuals on the ground alone. There was a whole cyber warfare element. We know that the facility in Natanz.
Sorry, can I just explain? Because that was, I believe, it was a car with a camera device and some sort of remote-controlled gun weapons. So it looks as if this attack on this nuclear scientist was actually done remotely from a sort of killer car, effectively, which was being controlled with no actual individuals there. So this is a new kind of warfare, isn't it, where one country puts a device into another country, which is actually a killer device, which can murder somebody. And when the death occurs, the authorities are called. All they find is a car on the opposite side of the road with a gun in it and a little aerial on the top, and obviously they can't then apprehend whoever's carried out that assassination.
Well, it's incredible, isn't it? And that's where we are at now. I mean, Stuxnet was the famous cyber warfare software or whatever mechanism you want to call it that the Israelis used in the first instance. The Americans and the Israelis' intelligence is tied at the hip. You really cannot separate the two. The fact is they exchange information, they're in full contact, and they coordinate activities. So whether the attack, for instance, which again had cyber elements, the attack on General Soleimani and the intelligence that went with it, the attack on Natanz, the nuclear facility, which went up in flames several times, actually, that it was attacked most recently a few months back. These are all huge acts of, if you like, warfare, really, and they were designed to trigger war between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States.
It sounds to me like a provocation, a war provocation. If you're going to hack into a nuclear facility and then take control of it in order to run it out of control, possibly to leak nuclear material, one of the things I heard about that, Saeed, was the initial, because obviously there are cyber defenses in these institutions, but you need to get your little bit of software, your Trojan horse or whatever it is, onto the system itself inside the plant. And they managed to do that by actually dropping one of these little memory sticks as bait with some soft pornography on, which one of the employees then plugged into a computer in the plant, and as soon as he plugged it in, that meant that the Trojan horse, the whatever it was that enabled people remotely to take over the plant was then injected into the software of the plant. And this has also been proven to be possible with cars. Even a compact disc put into a car, you wouldn't know anything about it. It would play like a normal CD. That can then inject software onto the bus of the computer on the car and enable that car to be taken over and steered remotely. And we've seen, you know, several instances where it does look as if a car has been steered remotely and someone has died as a result. Michael Hastings is probably the most obvious example, the guy that was doing 80 miles an hour with his foot on the brake, who had exposed the Americans in Afghanistan in a book. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you there, but I think it's important to look at, you know, some of the vectors which are used to get these Trojan horses in for these cyber attacks. And I come back to the point, the Americans are constantly moaning about Russian cyber attacks, and yet in their official literature it says it is virtually impossible to discern where a cyber attack has come from. And so how can they possibly know that the Russians are behind these recent attacks that they say are caused by Russia?
They can't. And I think the fact is that the Russians are not as naive as to sort of provoke wars that openly. I think they play a very canny game. You can see from Putin's policies, they are very much defensive policies. They protect their natural, if you like, spheres of influence. They're not in the business of, if you like, going on the offensive, from what I can see. But the Americans need an excuse. And it's rather like the Israelis with the Iranian situation. They will create excuses because there have been all sorts of false flags that we know. So you can trigger false flag operations with these kind of cyber ops as well. What worries me even more than this about this field of warfare that's emerging is that, of course, if you have got access to controls of nuclear sort of facilities like this, what's to say that, say, Israel or America don't have the codes or the access through the mechanisms they have to the nuclear weapons of Britain or the nuclear weapons of Russia, etc.? It's a really sort of frightening, murky world in that sense, that you have got forces that who are quite keen on triggering conflict for their own interests, who could decide at any point in time to unleash Armageddon if it suits them. And I just think that the international community, the world, needs to obviously pay attention to this far more. There isn't a regulation of the cyber warfare arena because it is relatively new and it gets very little attention. But I think it is increasingly going to become one of the most dangerous forms of warmongering.
Well, at least it's good to see that Biden and Putin have decided to start some sort of talks on trying to get some sort of agreements or whatever, treaty or whatever, on cyber warfare. And, of course, it's good that they're meeting face-to-face, particularly after the withdrawal of the ambassadors from Washington and Moscow, after these comments by Biden about Putin being evil and a killer and this sort of thing, which seemed a bit, I'm afraid, you know, I can understand why Putin thinks like he does. It's just infantile talk, really. Sort of playground stuff that's coming from Biden. But anyway, let's just move on to look at Israel, because we've got a new prime minister there. Naftali Bennett is somebody that I, on my show in Bristol, have had several times recordings of him speaking. There are indications that he may be even more of a religious extremist than Netanyahu. So what do you make of the final changes? Because at least I suppose the Israeli people and people around the world at least can be clear now that this is the end of the Netanyahu era, and that these elections in Israel have actually come to some sort of resolution, because we've been having several elections now, I think it's three, without any proper coalition being formed after it. Now at last something's happened.
Well, no change will be recognized by certainly the people of Palestine, if you like. The Palestinians themselves won't see this government as any different unless they actually take action in terms of the actual right of self-determination of Palestinians. And if they stop abusing, killing, murdering and maiming that part of the population that is both in Israel, but also in Gaza and across in the West Bank. I mean, Bennett, in fact, leads the ultra-nationalist Yamina party that champions the illegal Jewish settlements itself. So there, arguably, I mean, he himself is arguably even more right-wing than Netanyahu, if that's imaginable. He was in the Netanyahu-led governments as well. I mean, I think he was a defense minister at some point as well. He's opposed to Palestinian independence and strongly supports these illegal Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem, which the Palestinians and much of the international community see as a major obstacle to peace. So he's not a great option, but he's leading a coalition, which is a hodgepodge of all sorts of the weird and wonderful, the right wing, as well as a Palestinian party as well, albeit a very small one. And so it's a very odd alignment. The only thing they seem to have in common for sure is that they wanted Netanyahu out. So it's quite a fragile government in that sense, that may not be able to do as much as it perhaps wants to. They're talking about trying to create unity in Israel. I'm not sure what that means, the unity of who, but I assume it means that after the Palestinians in the Israel territory itself were effectively set upon, and lynchings, reports of attempted lynchings and marches, all of this, of course, he's got to try and control, because if there's fragmentation inside Israel, then, you know, the likes of the Islamic Republic of Iran or Hamas, etc., don't really need to do much. It'll self-implode. So his first job is to try and get a handle on that, I guess. He's also, of course, got to rebuild the morale and the credibility of the Israel defense mechanisms, because what happened was clearly a nightmare for them. They from conservative estimates of about 10% up to about 40% of missiles launched by Hamas, and we're talking about homemade rockets here, essentially, that penetrated the much vaunted so-called invincible Iron Dome. Well, that kind of idea is lying in tatters. I think the idea that a military solution for Israel in terms of keeping the Palestinians suppressed seems off the cards now. He's managed to also unite the Palestinians. Well, Netanyahu did. They've managed to unite the Palestinians across the West Bank and Gaza in a way that hasn't happened for a very long time. And he's also outed openly Iran into saying that, yes, we're with the Palestinians. We will give them more weapons. And they have something called the Gaza drone now, which can fire something like 13 missiles at a time and can fly into any region of Israel. So clearly, militarily, there's a problem. And the new establishment's two main issues are how to maintain the internal fragmented Israeli, if you like, population, which is now, of course, more fearful and worried as well, having seen all these bombs actually start landing on their territories. There's a lot of tension and fear there now, but also at the same time, how to essentially keep the Palestinians divided so they can rule them, and at the same time, how they can address the rise of the resistance axis in the region, with Iran, the Yemeni resistance, the Hezbollah in Lebanon, of course, and in Syria as well, and of course, the Iraqi resistance, which directly threatened Israel in the last exchange. So he's got a lot on his plate, and he doesn't have an altogether powerful government to be able to do that. But what he will have is the usual American backup, the US backup. It'll be very fascinating to see how they maneuver that support. I've heard also that they're already making moves on trying to get China to back off its support from Iran, because a lot of the support that Russia and China have provided the Islamic Republic of Iran have essentially weakened Israel. But we know that he's bombed Gaza yesterday. His first act has been to bomb Gaza, blaming balloons, firebomb balloons that were floated over. Again, it's a case of who started what. It's a chicken and egg. But then there's also the continued.
Well, hang on, because this definitely was these balloons. I mean, I'm not really sure how a balloon becomes threatening, but apparently they can catch fire, these balloons, and cause damage like a firebomb. I mean, these definitely happened before the airstrikes by Naftali Bennett on Gaza, didn't they? I mean, it does look as if that was a genuine reaction to the balloons.
They did, but if you recall, the last exchange was over the violation of East Jerusalem by radical right-wing groups and the military and the police itself. But this time again, of course, the first thing that this government did, Bennett did, was to allow the far-right groups to march in sectors of East Jerusalem with all the Israeli flags, etc., and basically another provocation. So this is a red line which the Hamas and a lot of the Palestinian resistance have clearly stated. They said, look, if you go into those regions, Al-Aqsa, or if you try to sort of gazump East Jerusalem, we're essentially going to start our actions again. So it's not like he didn't know. As soon as they allowed those right-wing groups to go ahead and do what they did, it was inevitable that they were going to get a response. So again, that's why I said chicken and egg. The Israelis will blame Hamas for flying these balloons. Hamas will say, well, we told you, don't violate Palestinian, if you like, rights in East Jerusalem. That's the red line.
You know what? I do compare some of this to what we saw in Belfast, particularly in Northern Ireland, obviously other towns there too, where you had these very provocative marches by the loyalist groups, the Orange Order, etc., into Catholic areas. It does sound as if, almost as if what's going on in Israel has been almost mimicking what was happening in Northern Ireland. But I'm also interested in the religious aspect of this, because I look at Northern Ireland. I lived over in Northern Ireland as well. And most of the people who lived there said, well, this isn't really about faith or religion at all. This is a cultural thing. You know, you've got a very powerful force, which is the Unionist Loyalist side, the Protestant side, who have just simply don't allow Catholics to do businesses, to set up factories, unless they're very small businesses, that they don't employ Catholics. And Catholics are very pushed to the margins of society. And so that's what it's about. It's not really about religion at all. What do you make of my comparison between Northern Ireland and what's been going on in Jerusalem and in Israel?
Well, of course, it's very hard to sort of completely get parallels that match in that regard. But there are elements which certainly overlap. But I would say that let's talk about Jewish extremism as a term. It's something that very rarely people will use. But Benjamin Netanyahu is essentially, he would say, he's a Jew. He's a Zionist, and he's a Jew. You know, both religiously, he would ascribe himself to the Judaic faith. Naftali Bennett certainly would. All of the extreme right-wing Israeli groups or individuals that go into the settlements certainly do it with a religious fervor, because they say Israel is built on a religious ethos and a concept of us coming and having this land which was given to us by God. So there is undeniably a religious element, but it's rather like ISIS saying that they are Muslims or they have Islam on their sides, because what they're doing is using those faiths or those religions as a cover for really political power and for you know, their own ends. So, you know, it's a weird one. But I would say that first of all, let's look at the context of this. Netanyahu has pushed for Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel. Jerusalem is a religiously shared space. Christians, Jews, Muslims all hold it equally dear. And, you know, therefore, for it to become really, I guess, the domain of one particular religion seems a nonsense. But clearly, under Trump and Netanyahu, we had a situation where it was a clear, evidence fact that they wanted to gazump Jerusalem for themselves as a capital. In fact, the embassies were all asked to move there as well. That was part of the game. Then, of course, you've also got the actual declaration, the formal acknowledgement that Israel is a Jewish state. This is on record. This is a normal part of the Israeli narrative and rhetoric politically at the moment. So there are two indications that religion is, to those who are politically in power at the moment, a very, very, very pertinent and very, if you like, very relevant part of their narrative for being there and doing what they do. Now, that on the one side, you know, is there. These are realities. At the same time, Trump encouraged the Americans that under his period, certainly overtly encouraged Israel to behave in this way, you know, with this kind of fervor. And they're Christian Zionists, for instance, in America, in terms of the lobbies in America, which push the narratives of a religious hegemony for the Jewish people or the Zionists in Israel, is very much there. I mean, there's an entire grassroots support from Christian Zionists for IPAC, etc., you know, the Jewish Zionist lobbies in America. And between them, these guys essentially clean up and control American policy towards Israel and make sure that it's always in its favor. So you can see there is a strong religious element there. And Hamas have made it very clear that they are an Islamically orientated group. So there are individuals and forces on the other side which are saying, look, we are overtly an Islamic force. But it's now very clear that what Hamas is asking for is a one-state solution. So what they're saying is not to create a religious state. They're saying that the right to self-determination for the Palestinians, the right of return for the Palestinians, the right for all those people who have a heritage link and contact with Israel should be equal, and there should be a democracy that emerges under an international auspices. This is also what their primary backers, military backers, the Iranians, are saying. Ayatollah Khamenei has said this time and time again, that this is our goal now. There will be no two-state solution. We can't compromise with these Zionist Jewish extremists within the Israeli fraternity, but we can deal with the indigenous Arab Jews and those people who want peace and want to live peacefully in a Palestine that is united. And I think this is the key, that now it's very hard for the current regimes to back off. They hem themselves into a corner, really pushing the narrative that Israel is all theirs and they must control all of it. And the Palestinians have been dehumanized to the point where it is an apartheid state, without a doubt there. But at the same time, how do these extremist Zionist people who say they are Jews, how do they back off? And how do the liberal Jews come back into some sort of prominence? Well, you know, they died a death since 2000. The Labour Party, or the left wing in Israel, has gone down to maybe something like 5% of the makeup of their parliament. So you can see that absolute decline from being in power to being an actual minor party in the sides. It indicates that those who are, if you like, reasonable, moderate within the Jewish Zionist fraternity in Israel, have very little power and very little say. They are the ones who maybe could influence some of the diaspora who pump in money and support and fund Israel to persuade this more extremist element to calm down, to make the concessions that are necessary to stop this outright, if you like, inevitable war, which I think is where it's heading. I think that all signs at the moment are heading towards an escalation of the clashes until ultimately there is a full-on war to settle who controls Palestine or occupied Palestine.
Well, yeah, I mean, and obviously East Jerusalem is absolutely key in all of this, which is supposed to have been, under international law, controlled by Arabs. But the Israeli state, Naftali Bennett, Netanyahu and the rest of them don't believe in international law. They believe it's God's law and God has given it to them. Although if they were to pick up the Old Testament, they would find quite a lot of evidence that all of the Old Testament prophets were saying, look, you've got to treat people who are not part of your own group. You've got to treat them well, as well as, you know, obviously there were a lot of wars and things in the Old Testament, but you know there's an instruction in there again and again that you will be judged by example. People will look at you and judge by the way you treat others, and they're obviously not treating, they're very much othering. Look, there's a bizarre situation side, and that is that we've had, ever since the medieval crusades, actually relative peace in Jerusalem and in the Israeli area, with certainly for the last few hundred years, Muslims, Christians and Jews living there in peace and harmony. So what's happened?
I think Zionism happened. Europe needing essentially what was described by one American politician, Europe and the Americans needing an aircraft carrier in the Middle East. And Israel is an American aircraft carrier sitting right in the middle of a Middle East where oil also happened. So two things: to control the oil and the geopolitical, geoeconomic interests of the United States and Europe, it was essentially agreed that Israel would become the policeman of the Middle East for the neoliberal or the liberal democracies, as it were. And essentially, this is what we've seen, that Israel has used that card to say, look, if you want the oil, and of course, let's not forget that oil props up the dollar. Since Richard Nixon dropped the gold standard, there's nothing else that gives the value to the dollar other than the oil supplies that were coming from Saudi Arabia. So it was absolutely vital for that oil to be safeguarded. Israel was supposed to be, if you like, the boots on the ground and the divide and rule balkanizing force. And in a way, it's a landing pad for Americans and the Western powers, so they can trust Israel at any time to allow them to use that territory as, a landing pad for their military if the Arabs had ever gone out of line. Don't forget, at that time, it was Jamal Abdel Nasser who was leading an Arab nationalist movement that they had to watch over. It was the Cold War period. In that Cold War period, they were obviously saying, we don't want Russian, if you like, influence and communism to take over the Arab world and threaten our oil. So, you know, most of the narrative that's formed around Israel was, it was in that period post, well, it was pre-Second World War and post-Second World War. That was one phase of it, establishing the Zionist state as a kind of foothold. It was followed by the Cold War period, in which Israel still used that war as a means of empowering itself and controlling the region. After that, it's become the war on terror. So again, Muslims, Islamism has also benefited Israel in terms of America saying, yes, we need Israel. We need to continue using Israel. And now, of course, it's all coming full circle. What with China and Russia and the Eurasian network reestablished, the Americans can still say, well, in order to challenge the rise of China and its economic machinations in the Middle East, we need Israel to stay there and to act as our as a bulwark. But the reality is that Israel has great relations with Russia. It has great relations with China too. It's doing business with all of them, and it has its own arrangements with them as well. I don't think that the Israelis would for one second bother with the Americans if they felt eventually they were going to get a better deal from others. The evidence for that being that Israel now has its own defense industry. It has the world's leading, arguably, tech industries there rooted in Israel. It's an independent financial state in itself. While they get $3.8 billion a year in terms of military aid from the Americans, actually, it's not American US aid which is supporting their economy or jobs or anything. That the Israelis are doing themselves through their own, if you like, what I would probably say is industrial espionage or the gifts given to them by a lot of the Zionist advocacy and lobby and the multi-billionaire, zillionaire moguls that are floating around in the background of the world. They are sustaining Israel. The question for them, the real problem for them, has been the Islamic Revolution of 1979 and the rise of the Islamic Republic and its very robust stand that Israel is the root cause of all of the problems in the Middle East. That's been their stance from day one. They have, without a doubt, been committed to rooting out that problem. And the fact is that Israel has also been absolutely committed to rooting out the Islamic Republic of Iran with psyops and black ops and wars, even using Saddam at one stage to invade Iran for 8 years of war continued. So to be honest with you, I think that this tussle between Iran and Israel, of course, Netanyahu said it in one interview. I heard him say, he said, look, he says, what's the biggest problem that faces Israel today? And he said, do you want it in one word? He said, yes. He said, Iran. He says, do you want it in three words? He said, Iran, Iran, Iran. So there, from the horse's mouth, Israel knows that unless it's willing to concede its apartheid rule, unless it's willing to give the Palestinians their full rights, unless it's willing to now concede a one-state solution, which is truly democratic, overseen by the international community, what they're going to get is a continued rise of a military response to them, encirclement from Hezbollah, as well as from the resistance in Palestine, and perhaps from other sources as well. I really honestly see us heading on course for a major war unless there's a major step in from the bigger powers to come up with a real solution that is fair and just for all, but particularly for the oppressed Palestinians.
Well, this is worrying, isn't it? Because Naftali Bennett, this new prime minister, taking over after really a very long time of Netanyahu. I think it was the mid-1990s with the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. Absolutely horrendous, because he was doing a hell of a lot to bring the various sides together for a proper peace agreement. It seemed that just in the 11th hour, that, you know, literally that died with him, and Netanyahu swept in. Of course, the guy that assassinated Rabin was also a supporter of Netanyahu. People sometimes forget that. And so there are various things about this new guy, Naftali Bennett. One is that as a youngster, he spent his time shuttling backwards and forwards from some sort of military colleges, backwards and forwards between the United States and Israel. So he really is part of this, you know, US-Israel lobby group. Then he's considered to be more right-wing than more nationalistic, more he wears the skull cap more than, if that means anything, than Netanyahu. But finally, you know, you touched on this, a massive tech industry that he actually founded, one of the big tech companies over in Israel. I think it was called RSA Security that he sold it to. It was called Cyota, C-Y-O-T-A. He founded that in 1999. And so it looks as if he's a cybersecurity expert. He's the sort of person that would know a lot about security systems and whether or not you can hack in and do cyber warfare. So I'm just trying to understand. It does sound to me, from what you're saying, from what I'm reading about Naftali Bennett, that we actually might be looking back on Netanyahu as a more of a moderate character even in future.
It's very possible. Look, the you've rightly pointed out the rise of Israel in terms of its abilities in modern technological and sort of abilities is absolutely astounding. But Unit 8200 is now a well-known operation or a military-led operation to, make sure that Israel is the number one in this field. And the fact is that Bennett was a military man himself. He was in Lebanon and was a part of a unit where I think they did massacre something like 84 civilians in Lebanon during the invasion at that time. And, you know, he proudly sits on that record. He was actually recorded at that time during the middle of that war. And it was quite clear that he was pretty panicked, and they did get a bruising. The Israelis didn't do well in either of their clashes with Hezbollah, by all accounts, and they have never ventured back to Lebanon since. But he still hasn't, of course, what I would say is he's not learned his lessons. There's a reality of Israel. It's something like 14 or 15 kilometers from the river to the sea at its smallest point. It has a population of around 14 million Palestinians in that region, which are still there one way or another. They themselves are relying largely on divide and rule tactics because Egypt is a lackey, servile, totalitarian state propped up by the Americans and beholden to the Israeli intelligence, etc. as well. The Jordanians are exactly the same. If you just see what they did over the last year or so, even when the latest king started squeaking a little bit, they immediately propped up one of his brothers, etc., to begin opposition movements. So they control these people, these kind of Arab, if you like, what I call Zio Arabs, really. They're people who largely are there as puppet leaders for the Americans and the Israelis to act as a buffer zone for Israel, to protect it from, if you like, those nations which are averse to it. But the fact is that Israel has borders with Syria, which is not enamored by Israeli violation of its sovereignty with jet strikes virtually every other day for goodness how long, knows how long. It's not friendly with Lebanon. Lebanon is on a war footing at all times with Hezbollah, the prime, if you like, fighting force. Now the Palestinian resistance are finally getting weapons and having the prospect of ballistic missiles or drones manufactured either internally or more likely by the Iranians is no joke. The Israelis have not faced this before. So what Bennett has to really look at is what is the chance of Israel actually surviving in a real war? Because in a real war, what happens, and all the evidence in Syria and in Yemen and Iraq tells us this, high-tech weapons, as ISIS had, funded by the Qataris, backed by the Americans, and logistically supported by the Turks, did nothing to win Iraq ultimately. They didn't hold Iraq. They couldn't. They didn't succeed in Syria. They've been hemmed in a little corner of Idlib, which again is only because the Russians and the Americans have come to an understanding, and the Turks have come to an understanding that for now there'll be a ceasefire. But again, the high-tech weapons didn't necessarily win the day there. Turn our attention to the latest Palestinian clashes. Again, there was no land invasion. Mr. Bennett should remember that Netanyahu dared not do a land invasion because the costs would be far too unthinkable for an army which has never really fought a proper war for very many decades. In Lebanon, when they went in, they lost a few hundred soldiers. That was enough for them. They went scampering back. Their tanks were revealed to be weak. The most powerful tanks in their armory were penetrated by techniques for missile firing, which have got worse. Underground tunnels, mechanisms, tactics of warfare, which Hezbollah have perfected, which have been also passed on now to the Palestinian resistance, without a doubt. All of this tells us that actually a fighting force of 18-year-old conscripts in Israel who reluctantly join an army and have no fighting experience and don't necessarily have the ability to sustain a real war means that they have to think about an option B. And I don't think that the likes of Bennett and these right-wing extremist Jewish Zionists have a plan B. They're still living in a deluded period of the supremacy of Israel, which certainly existed in the 60s and 70s, the late 60s and 70s and 80s, it doesn't exist anymore. There is a new reality. And in this new reality, if it's a military battle that they think they can win, or they can suppress and contain 14 million Palestinians ultimately, I think that they are seriously deluded, but they're banking on the international community. And by the international community, we know we mean Britain, France, America, and those people who have the veto rights within the UN to bail them out, to make sure that they're never completely overrun. I'm not so sure that even these international powers would ultimately be able to save the Israelis if push came to shove in a direct collision, which I think over the next 5 to 10 years seems almost inevitable, just given the trajectory of the ground, if you like, reality, which now exists.
Okay, Saeed, whereabouts can people find you and follow your work?
Well, I'm on YouTube by and large. I mean, I tend to sort of do a lot of analysis work for Press TV. So people Google Press TV and my name, they'll usually pop up with something there, I'm sure. But currently I'm developing a think tank called IMCD, which will hopefully come to more prominence, where we will try and have a more visible profile with some of our ideas and thoughts.
Okay, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.